The following program is a PBS Wisconsin original production.
Clerks prepare for a busy spring election as absentee ballot returns are already smashing records. And the 21st State of the Tribes address affirms the strength of tribal sovereignty. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Tonight on Here and Now, Zach Schultz reports on the history of the rape kit backlog, a central issue in the Supreme Court race. Immigration and deportation concerns hit close to home. One sheriff imparts his approach. Erica Aisi outlines priorities from the State of the Tribes address. And a Wisconsin manufacturer describes the uncertainty brought by tariffs. It's Here and Now for March 21.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.
Early voting is already underway in the spring election for a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. While many voters are focused on what decisions the winner will make as a member of the court for the next 10 years, Liberal candidate Susan Crawford wants voters to focus on decisions made by Conservative candidate Brad Schimmel 10 years ago. Here and Now senior political reporter Zach Schultz tells us why the rape kit backlog is an issue in this race.
10 years ago, Brad Schimmel was the newly elected Republican Attorney General of Wisconsin. As he came into office, Wisconsin was still counting how many untested sexual assault kits were sitting on evidence shelves in police stations and hospitals around the state, some of them decades old. Eventually, the tally reached more than 6,800.
We've been very instrumental in sounding the alarm on this issue.
Ilsa Connect is the policy director for the End the Backlog Initiative, a national group that was instrumental in pushing states across the country to inventory and test their backlog of sexual assault kits.
The issue is once you determine that you have 6,000 plus untested rape kits, what do you do about it? And that is definitely very complex.
We found those survivors, we talked to them, we got their consent to test those kits. And before my term of office as Attorney General, we tested over 4,000 kits. Every single kit that needed to be tested was done in that 4 years.
Brad Schimmel let thousands of rape kits go untested for years.
While rapists walked free.
And victims waited for justice.
As a candidate for a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Brad Schimmel stands by his work as Attorney General.
I'm proud of the work, what we accomplished for survivors of sexual violence.
His opponent, Susan Crawford, says he shouldn't be so proud.
He only put his foot on the gas when it became an issue in his reelection campaign. So again, this is Brad Schimmel's partisanship. His political future was at stake and he was worried about it. So he started working on that backlog and made some progress in it, but voters saw through it and they sent him home.
The key question is whether Schimmel showed enough urgency on this issue. Crawford says staffers in the Department of Justice told Schimmel about the backlog and asked him to get the Republican-controlled legislature to secure the resources needed to test the kits.
And he pushed him back and said, go look for a cheaper way to do this, look maybe for some grant funding.
We also recognized we couldn't just take 6,000 kits and dump them on the crime lab. They have day-to-day responsibilities. So we had to go forward and secure funding to be able to pay for getting those kits tested.
Eventually, the state secured more than $6 million in federal grants to process the backlog and send the tests to private labs. Schimmel announced the backlog was cleared just a couple of months before he was up for re-election in 2018. He lost, and the backlog delays were a big part of the ag campaign against him, just as they are in 2025.
Over 2 years, Brad Schimmel tested only 9 rape kits out of 6,000 that needed testing.
Connect says the concerns were not just partisan attacks. Her group had the same questions.
We kept sort of asking, what is going on? Why is it taking so long? There were, years when very, very few, I think it was even less than 10 kits were tested. And so we were engaging with folks in the state trying to find out, exactly what was happening. But it was a big concern in our office. What is going on in Wisconsin?
Crawford says the state budget that year provided new positions that Schimmel requested. They just weren't for the crime lab.
He was going to the legislature asking for a new unit of attorneys called the Solicitor General's Office that he then utilized for the entire time he was in office to pursue right-wing lawsuits. So those were Brad Schimmel's priorities instead of addressing this backlog of sexual assault kids.
It really does come down to where your priorities are. If this is a priority for a governor, an attorney general, I have seen them move mountains to get this done and to get it done, you know, relatively quickly.
Schimmel says he won't let attacks over the backlog go unanswered. But
frankly, we're ready for it. And we've got sheriffs that have come forward to talk about this very issue.
I was there when Brad Schimmel initiated the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, pushing hard to make sure that victims of sexual assault were able to see their offenders convicted to make sure that there is justice.
Schimmel says the people that worked on this issue with him agree he took the backlog seriously.
Check with groups like the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
We did ask the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault for comment, and they declined to weigh in, citing the, quote, highly partisan nature of this nonpartisan election. After the backlogged rape kits were tested, sexual assault charges and convictions soon followed.
This is a justice issue. I mean, I will just say overall, the rape kit backlog exists because of a failure of the criminal justice system as a whole to take sexual assault seriously and to prioritize testing of rape kits.
He got 9 kits tested in a period of 2 years. And, you know, justice delayed is justice denied.
We worked a miracle. And it's a scam to suggest to voters that this was anything other than that.
Reporting from Madison, I'm Zach Schultz for Here and Now.
In addition to that race for Wisconsin Supreme Court, there's also the statewide race for Superintendent of Public Instruction on the April 1st ballot. In this contest, incumbent Jill Underley faces challenger Brittany Kinzer. As part of his continuing coverage of this race, reporter Stephen Potter spoke to the candidates about why they want to lead the Department of Public Instruction.
My name is Brittany Kinzer. I am a lifelong educator, and I am running for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. I want to restore high standards because our children deserve so much better. I want to make sure that we are focusing on teaching reading, writing, and math so our kids can get a meaningful job, go to college, or master a trade. I want to make sure that we are partnering with our parents, making sure that the billions of dollars that we're spending is going into the classroom and supporting our great teachers, modernizing our funding formula, and also making sure that the Department of Public Instruction is transparent, is predictable, and innovative, so we can have the best school system in the country, and we can have 95% of our children reading well enough to go to college or have a career.
My name is Jill Underley. I am the incumbent for the Office of Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. And I've been doing the job, and I've been standing up for Wisconsin's public schools, rural schools and urban schools, my entire professional career. I'm a public servant through and through, but I also have the experience as a local school district superintendent. I have the licensure, not just as a teacher, but also as an administrator. And then I also have the experience working at the university and the connections between K-12 and higher education. I want a high quality public education that's accessible for all students. All students feel that they can belong and that they are welcome in their schools. I would like to see expansions for mental health, early childhood, and then also ways that we can retain and respect teachers.
We'll continue our coverage of that race next week, including more on the candidates and issues facing Wisconsin's education system. As deportations escalate across the country, the State Assembly this week passed a bill that would require county sheriffs to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. The bill would require that sheriffs request proof of legal presence in the U.S. from people held in a county jail on a felony charge and report them to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It would also require sheriffs to comply with federal detainer warrants, that is, holding an unauthorized person jailed on a criminal offense for ICE. Failure to comply would result in the loss of 15% of a county's shared revenue payments. If the bill makes it to the governor's desk, he says he will veto it. The Kewaunee County Sheriff has weighed in on the immigration issue, calling for keeping his community safe, while at the same time calling for compassion. Sheriff Matt Joske joins us now. And Sheriff, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you have said that you, of course, are committed to protecting your community by enforcing the laws, but you see the potential for, quote, untold levels of human suffering due to the rigid application of our laws. Does this bill strike you as that rigid application of laws?
No, this really doesn't, because you have to remember what we're talking about here, again, is that criminal activity. So that's the separation there. When we talk about people that are in our communities that are committing crimes, I think it's incumbent on us, right? It's absolutely our responsibility as law enforcement officials to collaborate and cooperate at all levels. We've been doing this for decades. It's unfortunate that it's reached this level, I think, of emotion and feeling, but we have to get back to basics that we always have and always will. Collaborate and cooperate with those state and federal entities that partner with us to keep our community safe.
So what would, in your mind, cause human suffering as a result of immigration rules and laws?
I think when we talk about the next phase, you know, what we're seeing happen now with this focus on those criminal elements in our country, again, I commend it. I'm grateful for it because that is in essence keeping our community safe. But it's when we get to this next phase, when we start talking about those individuals, these families that are here, how do we treat them? And I think you're referring to an article I wrote where we have to make sure that we don't put everything into one group, that we treat those here for whatever reason that they're here, but they're raising their children, working jobs, really trying to be contributing members of our society. I cannot imagine a reality where we treat them the same as the criminal elements. So that's where I make a separation in how we process it. And I hope that we as a country, I think we are. I think we're smart enough. I think we have the capability to separate this out and do the right thing when it comes to the families, to the men and women that are here honestly trying to make this country a better place.
So have you seen ICE in your community removing law-abiding, if unauthorized, immigrants?
Over the decades, again, this is nothing new. Over the decades, especially with the onset of our large agricultural farms, we have had ICE in our community. We have not taken active role in their operations. There's always a courtesy where they make us aware of their presence when they are engaged in their operations. But all these years, it's just been a matter of awareness, situational awareness, and support in the event that they would need us.
Now, I read that your officers do not ask for the status of people pulled over in a traffic stop or report people in the community without legal authorization to be in the U.S. to ICE. Why not?
Because at this point, there's really no purpose to it. I don't know where that information would be relevant. Again, it's not our role to enforce immigration laws. Now, mind you, when we do have somebody, whether it's on a traffic stop or if they're involved in a complaint, no different than anyone else in the community, we, of course, you know, we do collect names and information as any good law enforcement agency would. But as far as specifically asking for or targeting that population, again, there's really no merit to it.
Have you gotten any response to your persuasion position on this from other law enforcement across the state?
I think that overall, I would think that law enforcement, we're very like-minded. Again, our priority is keeping our community safe. But we also understand the need for compassion, for humanity, to look at this in a deeper sense and not just take everything as sort of a one-size-fits-all approach. So I do think there's a commonality across the state.
You've advocated also, however, without success, for the creation of a driver's card program in the state of Wisconsin. Why is that?
So that was over a decade ago, and it was a moment in time where the climate, I think, had lent itself to maybe that conversation. But unfortunately, just as in today's conversations, it automatically goes to a sense of entitlement, or what is that granting them? And I think from our perspective over a decade ago, it was about public safety, a mechanism by which folks could be trained to driving, making sure that they have the correct requirements, as you and I do, to operate on our roads, the ability to have auto insurance, so if and when they're involved in auto accidents. And then actually additional criteria could have been placed on it in regards to their obligation in pursuing citizenship. Now, had that been done over a decade ago, we might be looking at an entirely different landscape here in the state of Wisconsin. But again, unfortunately, a lot of times emotion and fear takes the day, and it never went anywhere. So I don't envision in today's climate that that would ever be something that we could resurrect.
All right. Well, Sheriff Matt Joske from Kewaunee County, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in Madison, tribal sovereignty, education, environmental threats, and public health were just some of the issues in the 21st annual State of the Tribes address at the state capitol this week. It was an address representing Wisconsin's 11 federally recognized Native American tribes. Here and Now and ICT reporter Erica Aisi was there.
Hello and welcome.
St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin Chairman Thomas Fowler addressed the full legislature.
My grandparents, great-grandparents, and ancestors knew that a positive relationship between tribes and the state and federal governments could only strengthen our communities.
Fowler said the trust responsibilities to the tribes require the government to uphold its commitment to protect Native land and Native rights, and asked for more support for the state's two reservation-based colleges.
St. Croix is in an educational desert, and our kids won't all find success moving so far from home, away from their support systems and culture.
Among other provisions affecting K through 12 schools currently before the legislature, Fowler urged passage of a bill permitting Native students to wear traditional clothes during public school ceremonies.
We ask that this body supports legislation that serves our students like AB 998, SB 85, so that school boards and charter schools don't prohibit American Indian students from wearing traditional regalia at a graduation ceremony.
Apache Danforth, member of Oneida Nation, was in attendance. She also applauded the legislation, saying it's time for Wisconsin to follow the lead of other states.
You know, many are the first ones graduating from high school in their family, so wearing the traditional regalia really honors that tradition of accomplishment.
On the environment, Fowler called for a unified voice between the state and the tribes over the transport through their lands of oil and gas.
Tribes have never been silent on their concern of the environmental hazards that come with pipelines. Our lands and waterways are at risk, putting our food, water, medicine, cultural practices at risk too.
As Fowler spoke to environmental protection, including the need to address climate change, Jonas Hill, member of the Oneida Nation, called the message impactful.
Climate change is real. We are seeing the effects. Maple season is in full effect right now, and the sap is running slow, duly because we haven't had a real hard winter hit us for some time. The wildlife and trees all depend on the environment.
Fowler's address touched on many difficult issues, including opioid addiction in Wisconsin's Native community, and as one prescription, called for the legalization of medical marijuana.
We need medical marijuana for chronic pain management, epilepsy, post-traumatic stress, and addiction. Addiction has left no family untouched in Indian country.
For her part, Danforth said such legislation should proceed with caution.
I really encourage them to think about our kids when they're looking at legislation and legalizing cannabis in our state and how they're protecting our children from abusing and using and having access to cannabis.
On a most essential issue of life and death among the tribal community, Fowler called missing and murdered Indigenous women a public health crisis.
This is too common for our people, and it must stop.
Danielle DeLong of Ho-Chunk Nation echoed the call and beseeches the state task force on the missing and murdered to focus its attention.
There are so many disproportionate numbers to our missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, and that task force needs to be prioritized with funding.
Fowler's address itself brought into sharp focus the concerns of life and land, health, and the future for tribes across Wisconsin, reminding the audience that fully realizing tribal sovereignty and self-governance is possible by working with governments and administrations.
Tribal nations seek common sense policy reforms that strengthen our ability to govern and protect our own people and preserve our own cultures and control our own lands and resources within our own boundaries. Because tribes are not children of the government.
From Madison, I'm Eric Ayisi with Here and Now and ICT.
Manufacturing is big business in Wisconsin. We're in the top 10 states nationally, with the second highest concentration of employees in the sector. The industrial machinery sector is Wisconsin's largest. So what do the 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico steel and aluminum mean for companies like Argonne Industries, which fabricates sheet metal components for major companies and imports 70% of its aluminum from Canada? We ask owner Greg Clement. Thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, good morning.
So what has been the immediate impact of the tariffs, especially for a company like yours that imports 70% of the aluminum from Canada?
So all our suppliers are getting the material from Canada, and what's happening is the aluminum has gone up 30%, stainless steel has gone up 100%, and hot roll, cold roll are averaging 30% increases. And that is a huge burden. That's just from January to March.
So do you continue to buy from Canada, or are you trying to buy domestically, or would that make a difference?
Like you said, 70% of the aluminum comes from Canada. You really don't have a lot of other resources. And we don't buy from Europe or China.
And so if the prices for that metal, those metals, has gone up to that extent, what does it mean for you and your business?
So luckily, most of our customers understand that material is a pass-through, so we're able to requote it and raise the pricing, but it typically will delay and cause them not to order as much as they had planned because of the expense of the material and the cost of the material and what it does for their end cost.
And so if their end costs go up to that extent, what does that mean downstream for consumers?
Yeah. So it's a tax on the consumers. They're going to pass it along. I mean, they're not going to hold the pricing. And the consumer's going to pay the tax. On average, consumers will pay $3,000 in result of the tariffs per year.
So we see you there, sitting inside your operation. What are the applications for your sheet metal fabrications, and what kinds of industries and products?
Yeah, power generation, dehumidification, scaffolding, a lot of different electrical enclosures, controls, things of that nature.
And so again, your customers are willing to pay more?
They don't want to, but they understand that we can't afford to, swallow that kind of increase, and that we would just lose margin.
And so what does that do in your mind to kind of the broader economy, right? If consumers are going to pay an extra $3,000 and your customers might be pulling back on how much they buy, what kind of effect does that have?
Yeah, I mean, it's raising inflation on the consumer, and it will slow the economy down temporarily. We're hoping that he could, solve these issues and not have the tariffs. But the problem is, we don't manufacture aluminum here, so we have to buy outside. So for me, the tariff something that we can't even manufacture, and then put that burden on the consumer is wrong.
So as to the domestic production of aluminum, that would seem to be what President Trump and his administration wants as a result of these tariffs, but how likely is it that the U.S. could ramp that up?
To build a mill, especially aluminum mill, would take very costly and would take a long time. I mean, you're talking he'd be out of the office by the time anything came online.
So the Fed is signaling about an economic slowdown, possibly a recession, on top of everything that's happening now. How concerning is that?
It's very concerning. We're going to have a record year this year. Based on our customers' excitement, forecasts, and they're all growing, and this could stop that growth.
What is your message, then, to the administration?
Let's not tariff something that we can't produce in the United States. Let's not add burden, like he's talking about cars, and even aluminum goes everywhere. And it's just going to increase costs for everyone, and then we are going to have to pay that 25%.
Do you feel as though that message is being heard?
I don't think it is. I think he has a different end game, and it would be nice to know what his end game is, because the other thing, have uncertainty on tariffs, creates uncertainty on customers buying. If you don't have certainty of the industry or what you're doing, they're gonna wait and delay.
Well, we will see how this goes, and we wish you luck. And thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
For more on this and other issues facing Wisconsin, visit our website at pbswisconsin.org and then click on the News tab. That's our program for tonight. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a good weekend.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.